Hello, everyone. This is Pete Braden with Godseen Give Wealth Management. We are going to start the call here with Rebecca Bowen in just about a minute's time. I'm going to let a few more people get onto the call, but we'll start in about a minute. Okay, great. Thanks. We'll have a few more people join, but we'll go ahead and get started. I don't want to penalize folks who are on time. Thanks so much for joining us this afternoon to be on this call. A quick housekeeping note before we get started. There is a chat feature at the bottom of your screen if you've dialed into this call through the Zoom meeting, if you're not just on audio. If you have questions that you'd like Rebecca or I to address at the end, please feel free to type that in on the chat feature. Only you will see it, and only us, not the other participants in the calls. And it would be very helpful if you put your name and contact information in there if we're not able to address it during the call, which should take about an hour. We will certainly follow up with you afterwards to make sure that your questions get answered. So did want to make sure you knew about that. Really, the genesis for this call was really our clients. We've had a number of clients who've expressed an interest in learning more about estate planning topics. And we do a number of these different types of calls, and we just felt like it'd be a really good opportunity to address that need for clients. So that's really what brought this program about here today. I'm going to lead off with just a few quick words about Godseen Gibb for those folks who are not Godseen Gibb clients before I turn it over to Rebecca to address probate avoidance planning. So quickly, very quickly, Godseen Gibb was founded in 1985. Frank Gibb, one of the co-founders, we're based here in Richmond, Virginia. We also have offices, two offices in South Carolina and one in Florida. We currently manage about $1.3 billion in client assets at the moment. We have a very experienced investment team, very seasoned team that I think is very helpful for a cycle like we're going through right now, a very difficult environment that we're going through here this year. We employ a long-term investment approach that focuses on large, high-quality companies that have strong balance sheets and are industry leaders in their sectors. And we really prefer to have individual stocks and bonds wherever possible for greater risk control. We will certainly use exchange-traded funds for smaller portfolios where needed, but wherever possible, we like to prefer to use individual stocks and bonds where we can. We've got a number of different investment strategies that we employ. I say a common theme across these is that we really focus on being risk averse and managing risk. And our clients get a tailored allocation across these different approaches based on their unique needs and objectives. We utilize a team approach, very importantly. So a wealth management advisor is the role that I fill here, and I'm a primary point of contact for clients, but we have other folks that our clients can access when needed. If they have a tax question, certainly can go directly to Mark Verdi and his team for tax questions. If they really have a portfolio question they need an answer from Jeannie McGowan and the portfolio team, they can access her directly as well. So we think it's very, very important that you know multiple people at our firm and you feel comfortable getting answers where you need to get them. We also understand that every client is unique and every client has different communication needs in terms of regularity, in terms of the types of communications. Many of our clients have found these calls to be very, very helpful, but others certainly prefer, you know, an in-person way to get their information. And so we certainly tailor that to what our clients' requirements are. We provide comprehensive wealth management. We started off in 1985 as a really traditional investment manager. We've added comprehensive financial planning to our menu. We've added tax preparation and planning as services that we can provide. A number of our clients have really seen the benefit of having one firm handle both their investment needs and their tax needs in one place. Many of our clients have been with us a long time and we have multiple generations of the same family that we manage money for in many instances. So we can help with wealth transition issues. We can help with educating the next generation of successful investors. That's a way we can help with our clients. Many of our clients are either retired or soon to be retired, not all, but many. And we can assist with analyzing issues as you prepare for retirement and helping you decide when you can feel comfortable to go ahead and do that. We don't sell insurance products, but we can consult on insurance matters. It's an important part of the financial planning process. And so we can work with an outside group to help provide price quotes and help provide information about long-term care insurance or life insurance or other types of insurance needs. Many of our clients are charitably inclined, and we can assist to help make sure that's done in the most tax-efficient manner possible. And then finally, estate planning assistance. We are not attorneys. We don't write and draft documents, but we can certainly coordinate efforts with high quality firms like Thompson McMullen to help make sure that those estate planning issues get addressed. A big way that we come to play there is just making sure that accounts get properly titled and funded, but we can help assist in that process. So that's enough about us, as they say. Let me now turn and give you a little bit of quick introduction for Rebecca Bowen. She has a very impressive biography. I don't have time to read it all, but I will point out the highlights that are relevant to our conversation today. But she's a director with Thompson McMullen, a law firm headquartered here in Richmond. In her role, she helps individuals and families create estate plans that address their wishes in the event of death or disability, among other roles. She's been recognized by Virginia Business Magazine as a legal elite in several different categories, including taxes, estates, and trusts category. She's been selected to Super Lawyers Virginia list in estate planning and probate category, as well as in Rising Stars. So she's a multiple winner in a number of different categories here. She earned her undergraduate degree, or BAs, from University of Virginia. All the Wahoos out there will be happy to hear that. She earned her law degree from University of Richmond. She's a member of the Virginia State Bar and the Richmond Bar Association. She's also a member of the Richmond Estate Planning Council. She's previously been an adjunct professor in estate and gift taxation at VCU. So hopefully she'll be able to put some of those teaching skills to work here for us today. And then finally, and maybe most importantly, she's a board member of the Richmond Animal League, and she has some adopted dogs at home. And she has that in common, a love of animals in common with a lot of our clients at God, See, and Give. I would say that might be one of the most common themes across all our clients, is we have a lot of animal lovers as clients. So I think that's maybe the most important criteria that, on your bio here. And with that, I will turn it over to Rebecca.
Thank you, Pete. And I think you just gave us an idea for our next session. We can talk about pet trusts and caring for your pets at death, if there's an interest there. So thank you for the introduction, and thank you to God, See, and Give for organizing and hosting this event, and for everyone who's joining us on the call today. As Pete mentioned, I'm at Thompson McMullen in Richmond, Virginia. Just to tell you a little bit about our firm, we are a mid-sized firm. We have our main offices in downtown Richmond at 100 Shaco Slip, and then we also have an office in Midlothian at Westchester Commons. You'll see on this slide, we cover a broad range of practice areas. Personally, I focus really on the estate planning and trust administration piece. We have about 26, I think now 27 attorneys, and we represent companies, state and local governments, and in your all's case, most importantly, individuals. To kind of move on into the slides, I'm going to turn off my video so that you all can focus on the slides. All right, there you go. So today our topic is probate avoidance planning. And, you know, I have a lot of clients that come into the office and they say, I want to avoid probate. So the first question is really, what is probate? What is it we're trying to avoid, and why are we so concerned about avoiding probate? So some of you may have gone through this process and you know exactly why you might want to avoid probate. But for those who haven't, probate is essentially the process of going down to the clerk's office after a decedent dies and recording the decedent's will with the clerk. Keep in mind that probate is different than qualification of a personal representative. Often those two things happen at the same appointment, but they don't necessarily have to. So a little bit of terminology when we're talking about personal representative, that can mean even an executor, which is what we call the personal representative if the decedent died with a will, or an administrator, which is what the personal representative is called if the decedent died without a will. So a lot of times you'll hear those used interchangeably, but most often we'll talk about executor or personal representative. So what actually happens at a probate appointment? So again, you're making an appointment with the clerk's office. You have to fill out a number of different forms. There's a probate information form, there's a list of heirs, and there's a probate tax return, and maybe some other ancillary forms depending on the estate. The decedent had a will, you bring the will with you to the clerk's office, and you essentially are telling the clerk that, you know, you are the named executor, this is the last will and testament of the decedent, you would like to have it recorded, and if you're qualified as executor, you basically are promising to administer the estate in accordance with the will. I think one of the most important things to keep in mind when we're talking about probate avoidance planning is that there are assets that pass through probate, and then there are assets that pass outside of probate. And if we're avoiding probate, the goal is to set up all your assets in a way that they pass outside of probate. So when we're talking about probate assets, those are only assets that are in the decedent's individual name without a beneficiary designation and without a joint or not jointly owned with rights of survivorship with another individual or individuals. So beyond the kind of hassle of having to make an appointment with the clerk and going down to the clerk's office, some other reasons to avoid probate are the fees and costs that are associated with probate. The probate tax is 10 cents per $100 in Virginia. So if you're talking about a $500,000 estate, it's only a $500 probate tax. To me, that alone is not the sole reason or even the most important reason to avoid probate. That's manageable. Also, really quickly, this is a little outside our topic, but the probate tax is different than the quote unquote estate tax. So when people talk about the estate tax, they're talking about the federal estate tax. Virginia does not have a state level estate tax. If there's any participants on the call in other states, your state might have a state level estate tax, but Virginia currently does not. The federal estate tax is only imposed on estates that exceed, right now it's $12,060,000. So it's a high number. We'll say 12 million to be easy. And that has nothing to do with the probate process. Regardless of whether your assets go through probate or pass outside of probate, they're most likely going to be kind of subject to that estate tax if they exceed 12 million. Other fees, you're going to have some clerk's fees, some recording fees, things along those lines. Also, the decedent's will becomes a public record when you probate it. So it's kind of like recording a deed. You could have a title company that's going to go back and pull up that will at some point. Anybody who's interested can go up and pull up someone's will. For me personally, I don't care. No one would be surprised what my will is going to say. But for some people, they don't want that publicity around their will. The last two bullet points are probably, in my mind, the more significant reasons to try to avoid probate. The first is that probate triggers the requirement to report to the Commissioner of Accounts. So the Commissioner of Accounts is a semi-judicial official. There's one for every jurisdiction, city or county in Virginia. And when you probate a will and qualify an executor, that triggers a requirement for the executor to first file an inventory with the commissioner, which is due within 4 months of the qualification, and then file an annual accounting with the commissioner, which is due 16 months after a qualification and covers the first year. You then have to file an annual accounting each year thereafter, as long as the estate is open. The accounting is a bear. The commissioners are very particular in terms of how they want information recorded. And you essentially have to report every piece of income and every distribution that comes in and out of the estate. You also have to provide documentation to support that. So copies of all the bank statements and brokerage account statements, copies of receipts, you know, anything that can document why you paid a bill. You know, the expectation is that an executor is supposed to prepare the accounting, but more often than not, for estates that we represent, we prepare the accounting because they're difficult to prepare. There's also the potential delay in administration when you're waiting for a probate appointment. So, you know, it depends on the jurisdiction you're in, but a lot of times you call up the clerk's office, maybe a week after death, you tell the clerk you need to make a probate appointment. They're probably scheduling at least 2 weeks, sometimes a month out from when you call. So you're looking at, on average, maybe a month from death before you actually get a probate appointment. Well, during that time period, there is nobody who has authority over the decedent's probate assets. So where I've seen this really become a problem is when you have a small business owner. So let's say you have an individual who is the sole member of an LLC. The LLC owns a restaurant. The individual dies unexpectedly. They were the only owner of the LLC. They were the only signatory on the LLC's bank account. There is nobody that has access to that bank account to continue to process payroll, to pay food vendors, to essentially continue to operate the business while you're waiting for that probate appointment to happen. So there can be really significant harm that results from having to wait that period of time. And a lot of that can be avoided by doing the proper planning upfront for that LLC interest to avoid probate. And we'll talk about kind of how that's done in a little bit. All right, so trust agreements to avoid probate. I put these first because this is probably the most common probate avoidance technique, is to have a poor over will to a revocable trust. Some of you are probably either familiar with this or already have this in place, which is great. So instead of the will saying, I give everything to my spouse, if my spouse predeceases me, then to my children, the will says, I give everything to my trust. And then the trust agreement is where we provide that everything goes to the spouse and then the children. The second point here is really the key point, though. That's all great, but for you to really utilize that trust agreement to avoid probate, you then have to take the next step of retitling assets and setting up your beneficiary designations so that those assets will pass directly to the trust at death, or maybe even transfer to the trust during your lifetime. This is where financial advisors like Pete and the other folks at Gotzi and Gibb are incredibly helpful to have involved as part of your estate planning process, because this is the part that clients forget to do. We tell them to do it, and then it's easy to just put the documents on the shelf and think I'll deal with it later. But you know, your financial advisor for the assets that they are involved with, they can help you fill out all the forms and set up the beneficiary designations the way they need to be done to pass to the trust. And we'll frequently work with them in terms of the appropriate language and information for those forms. So that's, you know, the poor over will to the revocable trust is a very common planning technique for probate avoidance. But the second step, which is really on the clients, is equally, if not more important in terms of setting up the beneficiary designations and the asset ownership. And talking about kind of beneficiary designations to avoid probate, a lot of them you're probably already familiar with. You know, life insurance and retirement assets are very common ones where you have to name a primary beneficiary and a contingent beneficiary. Hopefully when you apply for that policy or set up the retirement account, someone has prompted you to do that, but it's always a good idea to go double check those beneficiary designations, because a lot of times if you fail to set up a beneficiary, the default may be to your estate. So if the estate is the beneficiary, whether you've put it that way or that's a default result, those assets become probate assets. But if you have an individual or trust named as the beneficiary, then those assets are going to pass directly to those beneficiaries and avoid probate. Bank accounts and brokerage accounts, you can also put in place effectively beneficiary designations. The terminology is a little different. For bank accounts, it's a payable on death designation. For brokerage accounts, it's a transfer on death designation, but it's the same effect where at your death, that account is going to transfer on death or pay on death to the beneficiary you've named. It's not a probate asset. It goes directly to the beneficiary as soon as they have a death certificate available to provide to the financial institution. The last one, real estate, is very interesting and kind of a new development. I say new, but then I realized it was 2013, which is longer than I'd realized we'd had that in place. But Virginia allows transfer on death deeds. So even for your real estate, you could put a transfer on death designation for the real estate to pass directly to an individual or to a trust. You know, we're more comfortable with these now because at first we were not really sure how the title companies were going to handle that and what they would require. But, you know, they've been around long enough now that everyone's kind of on the same page that these work, and it's provided a easy way to transfer real estate at death outside of the probate process. And keep in mind with all of these beneficiary designations, except for unusual circumstances, they are revocable. So even that real estate transfer on death deed, you can revoke it and change it at any time. So none of this is set in stone unless for some reason you're making an irrevocable beneficiary designation. Joint ownership to avoid probate, that's another. There's certain types of joint ownership of property where the asset is going to pass directly to the joint owner and not be part of the decedent's probate estate. So a quick little summary of kind of the different types of joint ownership. The first one is tenants in common. So let's say you inherited real estate with your sibling from your parents and you each own 50%. most likely you inherited that as what's known as tenants in common. So you own 50% individually in your name and your sibling owns 50%. Your 50% at death is part of your probate estate. It's going to pass in accordance with your will or intestate succession. It doesn't automatically pass to the other owner. Another type of joint ownership is joint tenants with rights of survivorship. Again, the situation where you and your sibling have inherited property, and instead of owning it as tenants in common, you have decided to own it as joint tenants with rights of survivorship. That means that at the death of one of you, the ownership is going to pass directly to the survivor. That is a type of ownership that will avoid probate because it's not in your individual, it's in your individual name, but that right of survivorship designation means that it automatically by operation of law will pass to the surviving owner. The third type of joint ownership I wanted to mention is tenants by the entireties. This is only for spouses. And it's a joint ownership by spouses that has the similar right of survivorship quality. So one spouse dies and the property automatically passes to the surviving spouse. If you're married, you most likely own your house as tenants by the entireties with your spouse. Another benefit of tenants by the entireties is that it provides protection of the asset from the individual creditors of one spouse. So for instance, if a individual was in a car accident and they were the cause of that accident and then got sued, the claimant could not come after your house if you own it with your spouse as tenants by the entireties, because that is your individual creditor. They can't touch that tenants by the entireties asset. So often we'll see real estate and other assets owned jointly with a rights of survivorship provision. And that is a way to avoid probate of that asset because it's automatically going to pass to the survivor. I did want to point out a few kind of pros and cons though. So very frequently, especially when we have a single individual, we will see that the client will put a child on a bank account with them, often with rights of survivorship. So you're not just giving the child the right to sign the account. This isn't the POA, power of attorney situation. You're actually transferring joint ownership of the account to the child. There's some pros and cons to doing that. So a pro is that the child has immediate access to those funds, both during lifetime and at death. So your immediate expense at death is really going to be funeral expenses. Often what happens is that the children or your other family members are going to have to advance those costs and then be reimbursed by the estate later on. If you have a child who is a joint owner on an account though, that child is a joint owner. They can immediately pull funds from that account to cover your funeral. The downside though of this is that number one, because they're a joint owner, that bank account is potentially subject to the child's creditors if the child had a creditor claim. And where I see it get particularly sticky is the fact that that joint account will pass solely to that child. So if you have three children, you know, the child may or may not be willing and interested in sharing those funds with their siblings. It's really going to depend on your family dynamic and your family situation for whether you feel comfortable, you know, holding an account jointly in that way. I've seen it go both ways, as you can imagine. So there's legally no obligation for the child to share that account with the siblings. They may be willing to, and they may not. So that leads a little bit into the powers of attorney. So, you know, we're talking about those joint accounts and the benefit of the child who's the joint owner having access to the account. That can also be done through a power of attorney. A power of attorney is appointing an agent to make financial and legal decisions for you. So it's anything from accessing your bank accounts to signing contracts on your behalf, taking out loans, signing deeds and checks. If you do not have a power of attorney and you were to become incapacitated, somebody would have to petition the court to have a conservator appointed to handle your legal and financial affairs for you. You know, the downsides of that is there's cost and time involved with the conservatorship. You also don't get to pick who you want appointed as conservator because at that point you are incapacitated. The conservator also has to file accountings on a regular basis with the Commissioner of Accounts, kind of similar to what we talked about, where you have an executor who's reporting to the Commissioner of Accounts. And looking at powers of attorney, there's a number of different types. I mean, a lot of times there's kind of terminology that gets thrown out, you know, related to general versus special and durable powers of attorney. Most often what I recommend is a general power of attorney. You know, a special or specific power of attorney is really limited to a specific transaction. So possibly when you bought your house, you would have signed a specific power of attorney that appointed the closing attorney to sign any kind of ancillary last minute documents related to the closing. General power of attorney is what most clients need, where we're just talking about generally, we want to appoint someone to handle financial affairs for you. Durable power of attorney is the durable language kind of gets clients confused. It basically just means that it survives your incapacity. So you want a durable power of attorney. That's kind of the main point for that power of attorney, is to make sure that if you became incapacitated, someone can handle your affairs for you. Two different types of durable powers of attorney, and this is a conversation I frequently have with clients, is you can have an immediate power that is effective as soon as you sign it, or you could have what's called a springing power, which only becomes effective if there is some sort of certification, you know, usually from a doctor, that you're not able to handle your financial affairs. So for a lot of clients, when I explain this, their gut is, oh, I want a springing power. I don't really want to give somebody that authority unless I'm not able to act. You know, the scenario I try to give you where that may not be in your best interest is that I had a client who had a stroke. He was in a rehab facility. Physically, he was incapacitated. Mentally, he had no concerns about his mental capacity. He was fully able to understand financial and legal affairs. His daughter was named under the power of attorney, and it was a springing power of attorney. And she went to the bank to try to handle his paying some bills and getting things caught up with you know, bills at the house. And she couldn't use the power of attorney because there was no certification that he was mentally incapacitated, because he wasn't. But he certainly couldn't get down to the bank or do what he needed to do. So that's really an example. You know, I usually recommend an immediate power because it just gives a lot more flexibility to your agent. The caution there is that you absolutely have to pick somebody you trust. If you don't have somebody you trust, then you don't name them, because there's certainly room for abuse. And I also wanted to mention powers of attorney terminate at death. That's another point that often there seems to be some confusion about. I'll have a client call me up and their, you know, parent has passed. And again, this kind of goes back to accessing a bank account, and they say, well, it's fine. I have the power of attorney. I can pay the funeral expenses. Well, they can't. They can't use the power of attorney after death. It's only while the individual is living. So kind of trying to tie this back into the probate avoidance planning piece is that in Virginia, we have adopted what's called the Uniform Power of Attorney Act. And the Uniform Power of Attorney Act provides a long list of things that your agent can do, and then has a shorter list of things that require specific authority in the power of attorney for your agent to do. We often refer to these as quote unquote hot powers, because they have the potential to significantly change your estate plan. So it's things like the power to make gifts, to create, amend, revoke, or terminate a trust, create or change rights of survivorship, create or change beneficiary designations, and then a few others that really aren't as important. But if you think about giving somebody the ability to change a beneficiary designation or even change your trust, that's really, they could retitle all your assets and change your beneficiary designations in a way that you may not want. The other side of that is that including these hot powers can be really useful in then implementing a probate avoidance plan. So, you know, in the common scenario where you have come to me and we've put in place your power of will and your revocable trust agreement, and I give you instructions for updating your beneficiaries and retitling your assets, and you go home with it and you put it on the shelf. And then one of your children calls me and informs me that, you know, you no longer have the capacity to implement these changes. So in that case, we want them to have the ability to change maybe rights of survivorship or beneficiary designations. You know, the way I usually address this in my power of attorney is to give these give some of these powers, but that they have to be exercised in a manner consistent with your estate plan. So that really, I think, still gives the agent the ability to kind of follow through with this probate avoidance planning without changing the estate plan itself. You know, if the agent has a letter from me that says you should update the beneficiary designation to your trust, that's pretty clear in that case that that's going to be consistent with your estate plan. So something also, you know, if you have, and I can't think off the top of my head when the Uniform Power of Attorney Act was adopted, but if you have an older power of attorney, these things may or may not have been addressed in your older power of attorney. So it's good to kind of get those reviewed and updated on a regular basis to make sure you have any changes in the law that need to be addressed. Related to power of attorney, and I wanted to just talk about these because, again, there's maybe some confusion about authority between the two documents, is the Advanced Medical Directive, which appoints an agent to make decisions about your medical care. The agent under your Advanced Medical Directive can only act if you're not able to do so. So that's a key distinction. We talked about the power of attorney and giving your agent immediate authority. Somebody can't come in and make healthcare decisions for you if you have the capacity to do that. That's always your decision to make first. And we often include as part of the Advanced Medical Directive a living will. That is essentially the direction that if your death is imminent, you're in a persistent vegetative state, a coma, you know, and the doctor said you're not going to recover, it's the direction that you would want your agent to pull the plug. And, you know, we can draft that language however you want, but that's usually where we start because that's what most clients want. So just kind of talking about a few aging and caregiving concerns, you know, the importance of power of attorney and advanced medical directives, capacity to make a will and trust agreement, you know, again, consider including some of those hot powers in your power of attorney so that you do have some flexibility for your agent to be able to follow through with beneficiary designations and probate avoidance planning. You know, capacity is a key point too, because these are all things you want to address sooner rather than later, because we never know what's going to happen. And, you know, having that done is going to make everything a lot easier for your children and your family members going forward. The last point was just on pre-need funeral and burial or cremation arrangements, because I've seen this come up more and more. I think that is one of the best things you can do for your family, is to put in place, you know, some sort of pre-need contract with a funeral home, plan in advance for your burial and cremation. Tell your family what you would want in that situation. You know, they are going through so much right after death that the less decisions they have to make in that regard, in terms of trying to think about what mom or dad may have wanted, the easier it's going to be for them. And I think at this point, we're going to, you know, send it over to some questions. We actually have a good amount of time. I apologize if I spoke quickly. I tend to do so. I try to consciously slow down, but you know, please feel free. I'm going to turn my screen back on, and I think Pete's going to jump in as well, so we can answer any questions that folks might have at this point.
Great. Thanks, Rebecca. I appreciate it. And we do have a few questions here, and I think we'll have enough time to get through them all. But if not, again, we'll address them later. The first question I have here, or we have here, is if you have a married couple and the executor of your will is a family member out of state, in this case, Massachusetts, will a trust be sufficient for him to carry out our wishes upon death of both of us, or do we need to name an executor in state?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that really ties into the probate avoidance planning piece and why it is also another good reason to avoid probate if possible. So in Virginia, if your executor is a non-resident of Virginia, they will have to post surety on their bond when they qualify in the clerk's office. So a few terms I threw out there, your bond, or the executor's bond, is the executor's promise that they are not going to run away with the money. They are going to administer the estate in accordance with the will. They're going to do the right thing. So you go into the clerk's office, you raise your right hand, and you swear all that is true. You can never waive an executor's bond. The executor always has to give their bond in that regard. Surety on the bond is another piece of the bond. And it is essentially the requirement that the estate pays for an insurance company to come in and issue an insurance policy on the executor's bond. So if you have a $1 million estate, then the insurance policy is going to cover the executor possibly running away with $1 million. So most wills, you're going to see the language that you waive surety on the executor's bond because you just don't want to have that extra cost to the estate. Even if you waive surety on the bond, though, in Virginia, if you have a non-resident qualifying as executor, the court is required to require surety on their bond simply because it's a lot harder for a Virginia court to reach an out-of-state resident than it is an in-state resident if the executor were to do a bad thing. So kind of one of the workarounds to that is, again, just avoiding the probate process in general. So your trustee does not have to give surety on a bond. The trust is not overseen by the clerk's office. You know, the courts in Virginia do have jurisdiction over the trustee and the beneficiaries if the trustee did something wrong, but there's not that affirmative duty to go into the clerk's office and provide surety. So if you have a non-resident who you really want to be the one responsible for administering your estate and administering the trust, that pour of a will to a revocable trust structure is great. And then, but again, the most important part being that you need to then retitle assets and change beneficiaries to the trust. I will say too, maybe in the beginning, kind of, this is all very general advice. You know, your situation, I don't know the specifics of it. So that's very general advice, but you know, the residency of your named executor is important. And if they're not in Virginia, then all the more reason to try to do the probate avoidance planning so they don't have to qualify.
Great, thank you. There are some other elements to that question, which I think we'll have to take offline and kind of address afterwards, but that's helpful, great. Another question that's come in, I'm a single person with one child who is the sole beneficiary of my will and my power of attorney and knows all of my final wishes. My niece is secondary in case something happens to me and my daughter at the same time. I have a detailed will. Is a trust any better benefit to me?
Yeah, so that's a great question as well. And again, kind of goes back to the scenario where it depends on your individual situation. So if you have one child, your child is the beneficiary and also the executor under your will, the estate administration process is actually going to be easier for that child, because when you have the beneficiary and the executor as the same person, you don't have to file that full accounting with the Commissioner of Accounts. You get to file what's called a statement in lieu of account at the very end that says, I've paid all the creditors and I've distributed everything to myself. You know, you're only accountable to yourself in that scenario. You're not having to account to any other beneficiaries of the estate. So that is an easier estate administration process. You can also set up assets with your child as the beneficiary, the life insurance and the retirement, POD and TOD on the bank accounts and brokerage accounts and on any real estate. Where there's possible a downside there is that all works fine as long as your child survives. If your child is predeceased, if you're able to update everything to, I believe you said it was your niece, that's great. But if for some reason you have become incapacitated at that point, then that process could be a little harder for the niece if you haven't been able to update the beneficiary designations. Again, though, kind of going back to the power of attorney, the niece may have the authority to do that through the power of attorney.
Great. Thanks, Rebecca.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, another question here. If deceased home still has a mortgage but lots of equity, how do you pass that on to beneficiaries?
Yeah, so the mortgage has to be paid off somehow. So, you know, if the house just passes, you know, under the will or even as a TOD, that mortgage is going to stay in place. The mortgage company has a deed of trust on the house, which is security on the house. So those beneficiaries are not going to be able to sell that house until the mortgage is addressed. So somehow the mortgage does have to get paid off, whether it is from a sale of the house or it's from other assets of the estate. The mortgage most likely says that the decedent death is an event of default under the mortgage. So the beneficiaries, if they're going to keep the house, they're going to need to come in and refinance that mortgage. If they're going to sell it, then banks are usually very willing to work with beneficiaries for a reasonable period of time, you know, if they see that there's the process of getting the house ready to sell to pay off the mortgage. But then whatever is above the mortgage, the beneficiaries would get to keep.
Great, thank you. Next question, and obviously this has been addressed somewhat throughout the whole presentation, but you may have some other comments here. What are the most common pitfalls and missteps to avoid in the estate planning process?
Yeah, so I think, you know, as I mentioned a few times, failing to then take the next steps of updating beneficiary designations or retitling assets to your trust, or just not updating beneficiary designations at all. You know, I frequently have clients that come in and I will say, oh, great, you've got this life insurance policy. Who's the beneficiary? And they're like, oh, well, I think it's my mom, but she passed 5 years ago and they just haven't thought to even look at it. So even the process of, you know, sitting down with me to draft documents, we'll talk about these things in terms of, you know, making sure everything's up to date. The other thing I've seen happen more frequently recently is that just not being able to locate or forgetting about assets. You know, when we meet with clients, we have an intake form where we ask them to list all their assets. So we're making sure that we're kind of addressing everything we need to address in terms of retitling and beneficiary designations. And then it's also helpful if, you know, if they do pass or when they do pass and their children, their executor comes to us, we can say, well, as of this date, they had these assets. So let's look here. You know, we used to tell executors that if they watched the mail for several months, they would get all the account statements they need because account statements were sent monthly or quarterly by mail. But that's not the case anymore. Very few people get account statements in the mail. They get them online. So I recommend, you know, and I tell clients, you sign your documents, you keep them somewhere safe, and include with them a list of where your assets are located. You don't have to include values or account numbers if you don't want to, but at least put a general listing of where the executor needs to go to find everything. You have a Vanguard account, you have a, you know, Roth IRA here, you have a life insurance policy through MassMutual, so that they at least know the financial institutions to contact. I will mention as part of this, and I think it was in one of the slides and I glossed over it, Virginia does have a Small Estate Act process. So, and this reminded me of this because I have a case now where mom did everything she was supposed to do. We'd updated all the beneficiaries, we retitled assets, everything passed outside of probate. And then after her death, her daughter, who was the executor, called me, and it was about 5 months later. And she said, you know, we were just kind of cleaning out her file cabinet, and she's got $10,000 of savings bonds. They were from the 80s. Nobody remembers these. We forgot all about them. Mom forgot about them. Nobody was on top of that. So in Virginia, if you have probate assets that are under $50,000, which was the case here, because everything else passed outside of probate, you can go through kind of a small estate process by probating the will, but you don't have to qualify an executor. And probating the will is just going to the clerk's office and recording the will. The qualifying the executor is the piece that then triggers all the filing requirements with the Commissioner of Accounts that we usually want to avoid. So it's a much easier process if you only have to probate the will and can use a small estate affidavit to then transfer those savings bonds. And we kind of learned as part of this process that Department of Treasury also has their own Small Estate Act form. You need to use both the state form and the Department of Treasury's form. But the lesson there being, don't run out and immediately qualify and probate the will because you might not need to. There might be some easier ways we can get assets transferred. But tying that back into just, you know, try to remember what assets you have and keeping kind of an ongoing list. I think tax time is a great time to pull out your estate planning documents and pull out that list and update that list as you need to, because you're looking at all the information you got for your tax returns. And a lot of times that will kind of remind you of what might need to be updated on the asset list.
Great. And I've got, I think this is Jog, a similar question here, a related question, and I'll expand on it a little bit. How can you address online accounts and accessing and shutting those down? And I guess I'd expand on that in terms of kind of any best practices you've seen in terms of Omega files or documenting things to make things easy for an executor or executors. So kind of tie that in with that question.
Yeah, that is a really kind of a tough one and hot topic right now, as you can imagine, because more and more of our lives occur online and our financial transactions occur online. And the difficulty is that every provider, when you click that little terms and conditions, when you sign up for every account that you sign up on, is going to address this, but in maybe a different way than you would like. And you don't get to negotiate that with them. So we include language in both our wills and our trust agreements around digital assets, essentially specifically authorizing the executor to access your digital assets. That being said, you know, you may have heard horror stories of Yahoo refusing to release password information, and they are really within their rights to do that based on their terms and conditions. So I kind of feel that keeping, you know, in terms of, there's a difference between the financial assets and maybe your Facebook account and your Instagram and your TikTok and all that kind of stuff. There is a process through Facebook. There is a process through all those service providers to actually close down those accounts. I've found that process is a lot of times more headache and heartache than the effort, you know, than it really is worth doing. You know, in terms of the financial accounts, you really are not supposed to access anyone else's financial accounts, you know, after death, you know, online. I'm not going to say it doesn't happen because people do it all the time. But to me, it's for information purposes. You're trying to locate assets, and then you're calling Vanguard or you're calling someone on the phone and starting the proper procedure of making a claim and getting the assets transferred. You shouldn't log in to the Vanguard account under, you know, your decedent's username and password and directly transfer assets from there. You don't have the authority to do it that way. So, you know, I think that the sharing of the passwords can be helpful to gain information, but you really shouldn't use it to transact any kind of, you know, business for the decedent. You know, there are a lot of, and I can't really provide a professional opinion on it. You know, I know there's a lot of password vaults out there that people use, LastPass, maybe there's one called OnePass, I think. I don't really, you know, I'm sure they can be hacked as well. And I, as long as you've got somebody who has that information to access those, I think that's something else you could leave with your kind of list of documents. And real quick, I'll mention, I don't know if anyone has any cryptocurrency. That's another area that we are trying to keep up with the rest of the world on in terms of how we handle that. You know, I'm learning so much about it. It's basically you need a key. And if you lose that kind of key that has a bunch of numbers and letters on it, you don't have an asset anymore. So making sure you have that information in some kind of format to leave for your executor, or that asset could be lost. You know, I've heard the recommendation of putting it on a thumb drive and keeping that thumb drive with your original estate planning documents. And again, letting your executor know that you have those assets, because that's not going to come through on a statement in the mail. So that's becoming more and more important.
Great, thanks. Got another question here. In the state of Virginia, if your executor is a family out of state, does the out of state executor have to have Virginia resident present when approaching the commissioner?
So it's not so much the commissioner that's an issue, it's the clerk's office when you qualify. If you have, so we talked about, if you have a non-Virginia resident, they have to post surety on their bond. If you have a co-executor where you have one resident of Virginia and one non-resident, then they will let you waive the surety. But you've got to have a Virginia resident as a co-executor for that non-Virginia resident to not have to provide the surety.
We might have time for one more or maybe two more. If I have a will and or I've titled my assets to best avoid probate, do I still have to file an estate tax return?
Yeah, so good question. Again, that's kind of related to the distinction between probate tax and estate tax. So the estate tax, and there are certainly exceptions to this, there's lots of fancy trusts we can draft to get assets out of your estate from an estate tax standpoint, but generally your estate consists of all of your assets at your death, regardless of whether you've done any probate avoidance planning on those. So that's going to include the life insurance that has a beneficiary designation, the retirement accounts, all of that is included as part of the estate for estate tax purposes. Again, the estate tax exemption amount right now is $12 million. It's a generous exemption amount. So as long as your total assets, your total worth is under $12 million, you don't have to worry about estate taxes. And that's per individual. So when you have a married couple, you have, you know, $24 million before you need to start worrying about that. Although there is some planning, you know, if you're close to that $12 million number, there's still some tax planning we'd want to incorporate in your documents. But the estate tax is different than the probate tax. The probate tax is your local tax that you're paying to your local circuit court. And it's not nearly as high as the estate tax. It's going to be on every dollar of the probate estate, but it's not as high of a tax.
All right. Very good. Well, let me see. I think that gets us through the questions that we have, unless there's a last minute one, but I think that gets us there. So I really want to thank you, Rebecca, for joining us for the call to address a topic that comes up in conversations all the time. And certainly, you know, not everybody has legal training, and there's a lot of things to know here. And a lot of, just when you think you know it, the rules change. So it can be a real challenge, but we really appreciate you getting on and talking with us about these issues today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much. Thanks all.
All right. Thank you, everyone.